Welcome to Breaking Down Patriarchy. I'm Amy McPhee, Olivest. When I was a little girl in Seattle, our across-the-street neighbors were a South Asian Muslim family named the Chaudhrys. They were our emergency contacts, and I remember a few times coming home from school to find that my mom wasn't home, so I just trotted across the street where Mrs. Chaudhry would have cookies and lemonade for me. And their teenage daughters were my first babysitters, and I remember that when we moved to Denver from Seattle, they came over to say goodbye to our family, and we all cried because they were like our family. And then later in college, I studied abroad for 5 months in Palestine, Jordan, and Egypt, and I took many classes on Islamic religion and history. Throughout my adult life, I've had many, many Muslim friends for whom I have a very strong sense of sisterhood and kinship, based partly on a lot of similarities in our faith traditions. But it's only been in the past few years that I've developed a feminist consciousness of my own in my own context. And so now I so badly wish that I could go back and talk with the Chaudhry women and with the women I knew in the Near East, because I would have so many more questions for them now. So you can imagine that when I saw the book titled Sisters in the Mirror, A History of Muslim Women and the Global Politics of Feminism, I bought it immediately. And I was delighted to find that it not only was an incredibly informative work of scholarship, it was also so easy to read and so relatable. So I highly recommend this book to listeners who are interested in understanding their Muslim sisters better. And I am so honored to welcome to the podcast the author of this book, Dr. Elora Shehabuddin. Welcome, Elora.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me, Amy.
I'm so excited for this conversation. And again, just have to tell you how much I enjoyed the book. I'm willing to put myself through very dense academic reading. I do that all the time. I'm in a PhD program and some of the books I've read on the podcast are dense. And yours was just like kind of riveting. It was a page turner. I couldn't wait to read it.
So much.
Thank you for your research and thank you for writing in a way that was just a joy to read.
Thank you.
I'll start out, as I always do on the podcast, by introducing you professionally, and then we'll have you tell your story yourself afterwards.
Thank you.
Dr. Elora Shehabuddin is a professor of gender and women's studies and global studies at UC Berkeley. Prior to moving to Berkeley in 2022, she was professor of transnational Asian studies and core faculty in the Center for Study of Women, Gender, and Sexuality at Rice University. Before that, she was an assistant professor of women's studies and political science at UC Irvine. She received her BA in social studies from Harvard and her PhD in politics from Princeton. She is the author of many, many articles and multiple books, including the award-winning Sisters in the Mirror, A History of Muslim Women and the Global Politics of Feminism, which was published in 2021. And like I mentioned, we'll be discussing today. And exciting news, the paperback is available. Is it available quite yet, Elora?
I think it is. They said early March. So I think so.
Okay, fabulous. I have the hardcover and it was wonderful, but yes, now the paperback is out. So, well, again, welcome. And I wonder if you could start us off by telling us a little bit more about you, where you're from, and kind of the factors in your personal life that brought you to the work that you do today.
Okay, of course. Thank you. I consider myself to be from Bangladesh, even though I've been in the U.S. for many years now. And the interesting part about that is that growing up, I spent very little time in Bangladesh. My father's job took us all over. So I was actually born in what was then West Pakistan. East and West Pakistan were a country until 1971, when East Pakistan became Bangladesh after a war of independence. So I was born in what was then West Pakistan. My parents are both from East Pakistan and Bangladesh. And then because of my father's job, we moved around. So I actually grew up in India, France, Lebanon, a few years in Bangladesh, England. I finished high school when my parents were in Poland, but I had to go to school in England because there were no English schools in the 1980s in Poland beyond the eighth grade. And then I came to the U.S. for college. So my family background is Muslim from what is now Bangladesh, so Bengali Muslim. I'm the oldest of four sisters. I think that sort of is always there for me. Mm-hmm. No brothers. And then I came to the U.S. for college and I studied this special major at Harvard called social studies, where you draw on all the different social sciences. You put together your own course of study, even though there are some required courses you do every year, and then you have to write a senior thesis. And I loved the process of writing a senior thesis. I said, okay, I don't see myself doing a 9-to-5 job. I'll just go to grad school, even though that hadn't been necessarily the plan before. And so I like my life choices in terms of, you know, the professional path. I like doing research. I like reading, writing. So that's where it ended up. I never got a formal degree of any kind in women's studies. It was around even when I was in college, but I focused on women and gender issues even for my senior thesis, and then continued to do that in graduate school. I just never got around to doing anything formal, like a diploma or a certificate in it. So right after 9/11, there was a lot of attention, you know, on Afghan women, on women in the blue burqas. And, you know, many people have written about this. Others also, how Nora Bush gave the first, it was the first time that a first lady addressed the nation, gave a radio address. There was Laura Bush as the Americans were going into Afghanistan to, you know, find Al-Qaeda. But the way she pitched it was, it's to save the women of Afghanistan. So after the Americans go in, they will be able to finally sing and dance and, you know, get an education, et cetera, and throw off those blue burqas. So that was at the level of the government. And there were a lot of Muslim and ex-Muslim, very prominently ex-Muslim women writing in the U.S. at the time saying, yes, we have to go find these terrorists. And yes, Islam is a terrible religion for women and we need to save these women. So this idea that Muslim women were oppressed became very commonplace, again, in a new way, post-September 2001. And those women, so in particular, I have in mind Irshad Manji and Ayaan Hirsi Ali, those were the most two prominent ones. You know, they were celebrated in the New York Times as, you know, these are the true feminists of Islam and, you know, let's celebrate what they're doing because they're finally speaking out against the injustices of Islam. So that's when I and many others, you know, sort of sat back and thought about this. For me, my interest was surely, of course, there are problems in Muslim communities facing Muslim women, just as there are problems facing women in all communities. Surely these are not the first women to have spoken up about this. So, I mean, you know, I'd heard stories, I knew of fact people, but I wanted to do a more in-depth study. So I decided to look at how, in a sort of systematic academic way, how feminists, men and women, and, you know, feminism is a relatively recent term. So how people, men and women in Muslim communities had spoken out about problems in Muslim societies, facing women in Muslim societies, without colluding with the colonial power or, in this case, you know, post 9/11 American power. You know, how do you make these criticisms without necessarily falling into this trap of then saying all of Islam is terrible, etc. So I decided to do a more historical study to see how things had changed over time, but also look at it in relation to how feminism was evolving in the West at the same time in non-Muslim context. So I see it as a sort of historical sort of depth and transnational breadth. To see, you know, so that's how the project began. It was a much longer book and I had to cut, you know, fix it for what became the book. But that's how it began, I guess. You know, I started just reading stuff that is way outside my historical comfort zone. And it was interesting. So a lot of this work has been done by other people. I mean, I will not say that I discovered this author or that author. Some I may have along the way. But there's been a great deal of scholarship. What was interesting for me was to create this genealogy. So drawing on the work that other people have done so brilliantly, but putting them in this sort of longer history, right? So people who write about the early 18th century just focus on that. So I wanted to see, okay, 18th century, what happened before? What happened after? What happened like 100 years later? So that's where I saw myself coming in mm-hmm. to do that.
I'm a sucker for a chronological timeline, and I loved it. I thought that it was so well done in that very sense of showing like what was the context that came before and then kind of some causal through lines that, yeah, made so much sense and were great. Yeah. So I wonder if, as we dive into the book now, if you can kind of set the stage by telling us about the population that you focus on in the book. it might be news to a lot of listeners that South Asian Muslims outnumber Muslims in the Arab world. Is that right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And Muslims in Southeast Asia, you know, are an even bigger population. So, you know, it's sort of what we keep telling our students in class, not all Arabs are Muslims and not all Muslims are Arabs, right? So just we can start from there. So the South Asian Muslim population, which I focus on partly as a way to add to the literature that's out there on Muslims. So of course, there's been scholarship on South Asia and South Asian Muslims, but a lot of the scholarship on Muslims has been about the Arab world and the Middle East more generally, which would then include Turkey and Iran, which are, you know, not Arab. So I wanted to just focus on, you know, using the language that I know best, Bengali, using the Bengali language to understand and to get to material from that part of the world. So part of the argument is that, you know, there's so many Muslims there, why aren't we paying more attention to it? So part of it is the demographic argument, but also it's just a very different history. So if all our ideas about Muslim women are based on how things emerged historically in the Arab world, then you're missing out on many other things. So, you know, South Asia, then Bengal specifically is interesting because, you know, it was colonized by the English for almost 200 years. Islam came to Bengal quite early, but in a very different way, mostly through Sufi preachers. So it spread, you know, not by conquest, but through these holy men who set up a mosque and brought in communities. So the history of how it evolved is different, the way it evolved is different, and then the interactions, what, you know, for me is important in every aspect of the book, is who were they interacting with. So Bengal has a very large Hindu community, right, and Buddhists and Christians. So in that sense, it's obviously different from Arab Muslims who don't interact with Hindus and Buddhists on a regular basis, right? So for me, there are all these reasons, even beyond the demographic argument, on why to focus on Bengal. And as I said, I know Bengali, so that's where I felt I could make a contribution. Yeah, I think that's the main, yeah, argument for why there. Yeah.
Perfect. Yeah, perfect. Okay, well, let's dive into the book. I have some specific questions for you.
Okay.
And the first one is just a short quote that I'll read. You write that feminist movements in the West and in Muslim societies have developed in tandem rather than in isolation, even helping to construct one another. That was a big aha moment for me. So can you tell us how feminist movements in the West and feminist movements in Muslim societies have constructed one another?
So I begin by saying how we tend to talk about these different feminist movements. So one story is that feminism developed in the West and then spread to the rest of the world, right? It's like sharing the good news of feminism. Mm-hmm. You know, it begins here and then, you know, it goes everywhere and people then tweak it to suit their needs. And then the other story we often hear is that, no, we've all had our indigenous feminism, you know, our local versions of feminism. So there's been a Bengali feminism, you know, Malaysian feminism, et cetera, it's a Russian feminism. And these have all developed separately. We, you know, what I've tried to do here is show that that may be the case, but they've always been connected. So by that, I mean, not that they've always cooperated and gotten along. Absolutely not. I mean, that becomes very clear. But that given relationships of power between different countries, it cannot be that feminism in one place emerged in a vacuum, sort of isolated from what's happening elsewhere. So what I tried to do, the main context that I pay attention to through all these periods is, what was the power relation between, in the case of this book, I focus on Britain, South Asia, and then after the Second World War, the US, because that becomes much more powerful than Britain after the Second World War. So what is the power relation between Britain and South Asia? So initially, the British were actually in a almost inferior position. So if you imagine, you know, the English Queen, Queen Elizabeth and James I, etc., 17th century, 16th and 17th century, sending emissaries to the court of the great Mughal emperor saying, please give us permission to trade here, to set up factories, to do these things. So in a sense, they were the ones who were supplicants to the Mughal court, which did not cover all of India, but was still an enormous, awe-inspiring court. But then in 1757, the British start controlling, you know, India politically, and it starts in Bengal and then spreads to most of the rest of India. So then the power dynamic switches. So I'm interested in seeing how ideas about women on the other side, I mean, it's very simplistic, but it's easier to think about it as sides, even though it's much more complicated than that, but how ideas about women on the other side were shaped by this larger power relationship, which is unequal. So one of the things with inequality is that the more powerful side is aware of what's happening in the other side, but not as affected by it as the weaker side. So by the time feminism becomes a thing, you know, in the past, people thought about, oh, this is not fair, but, you know, there's not much we can do about it. Okay. But by the late 19th century, in both the West and in the Muslim world, you know, people are organizing, men and women are fighting to change things. But by then, the West was very much in a position of dominance over, you know, most of these Muslim regions. So then they can say that, oh, well, they're not as good enough feminists as we are because we know what feminism is, right? So colonialism tied with this feminist arrogance, if you will, shapes how they think about the other side. And then on the other side, Muslims, the way they experience feminism is sometimes, you know, with efforts to impose a Western kind of feminism on them. And because it's coming often as the handmaiden of colonialism, it's rejected. And because it's seen as alien and not tied to local conditions and local demands. On the other side, it also means that when they are fighting for women's rights, it's very hard to separate it from the fight against colonialism. So it becomes tied to anti-colonial nationalism, you know, and then in other contexts, the fight against racism within the Americas, for example. So feminism looks different. And it also allows people on the Muslim side to say, well, we don't like the look of that. That's not the kind of feminism we want, you know, just on the matter of the issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's great. Okay, let's talk about a specific topic that was pretty consistent through the book that was so interesting to me, and that is the harem. So if we go back to what you were just talking about in terms of like these European powers coming into a great civilization that's completely foreign to them, that they don't really understand, and they observe these cultural practices, and then they have their ideas about what they mean. So can you explain what was a harem really in its own context, and then how was it perceived in the West?
So a harem is basically the private quarters of a Muslim home, or, you know, or any elite home, actually, in that part of the world wouldn't even necessarily have to be Muslim, but it had, you know, maybe more rules associated with it when it was in a Muslim home. But it's a private quarters where women and children would spend most of their time. So if a man had to receive guests, there would be a separate section area to do that, like a front room or a more public room. So the fact that it's only in elite homes or in the homes of the wealthy is important because most homes can't afford to have all these separate areas. So for travelers to the East who encountered this, you know, in places like Syria or the Ottoman Empire, etc., the men, it's mostly male travelers who go, or at least who leave us records. So your male European travelers going to these places, they went with this arrogance that we're here to see. It's sort of like travelers today. Americans will go and say, what do you mean I can't see everything? That's, you know, it's sort of, so they expected to be able to gain entrance. And when they weren't allowed, at least in the elite homes, they sort of sat back and came up with fantastical ideas about what happens in this place that they're not allowed to see, right? So they imagined that, you know, there's a great deal of the same-sex sexual activity going on in there, that they were all lying around waiting for the master to come so that they could all have sex. So all these, that these, and then they were all lying around naked too. So, and you get that from a lot of the great art of the 19th century. If you, you know, in the big museums, the Turkish bath by people like Delacroix and Ingres and Renoir, all these big European artists, they have lots of these big famous paintings of naked women sitting around, and that became the idea of the harem. So we know for a fact that no man would have been allowed in to see these places. So we know that this is their imagination of it, you know, these, and those, and for the paintings, for the painters themselves, I think most of the big ones didn't actually travel. So that even the paintings were based on writings by men who had never seen these places, right? So it's like, you know, male fantasy on male fantasy on male fantasy.
Yeah.
In reality, there were, these quarters were for the women and children of the household. Even boys would be there until they were old enough to be out and to hang out with adult men. And, you know, that's where they did their housework. That's where they did their studying. That's where they would listen. Again, depending on the wealth of the house, they would read to one another. They would recite poetry. They would, you know, sew and, you know, do whatever. But it was just a private space. And what's interesting is that some early 17th century, English writers like Mary Estelle, who was called the, you know, first English feminist. So she, 100 years before Mary Wollstonecraft, but not as well known, she wrote this text where she laid out a plan for a female academy, all female. So she was a theologian, so she was interested in this all female place where women could devote themselves to studying and to, the, you know, devote themselves to God and such things. Mary Montagu, who is the first English woman to actually travel to the Ottoman Empire and to actually gain access to the harem, you know, the women's private quarters, was really impressed with what she saw. Really impressed and really surprised, because she too had read all those male fantasies about what happens there. She said, oh, it's so boring. You know, what they do, it's so mundane in a sense, right? And she has lots of good stories that many people have written about, and I used, you know, I draw on some of that for the book. But because the idea of the harem was so well entrenched in Europe and in England at the time, you know, what Montagu said didn't really make any dent in that idea. So Estelle is interesting because she, you know, she had all these misconceptions about Muslim women, but she didn't see that her idea of this, of the value of an all-female space, you know, mapped on quite accurately to the private quarters that did exist for women in that part of the world.
Yeah. So interesting. I wanted to bring up too, because you mentioned the Ottoman Empire, that you write about how the Ottoman Empire, just that one context, was kind of a symbol or a stand-in for the entire Muslim world in the 17th and 18th centuries. And you wrote, and this just, it made me so sad, and it was really shocking to me. You wrote that in the 1699 dictionary, a Turk was described as any cruel, hard-hearted man. And then the Oxford English Dictionary still defines Turk as a cruel, rigorous, or tyrannical person, one who behaves barbarically or savagely, or also a man who treats his wife harshly. I did not know that. And that, well,
so just to be clear and to be a little fair to the Oxford English Dictionary, I think it's one of the later meanings. So it's not
the
bride,
you know,
I don't
meaning.
Remember if it said obsolete, but you know, that 1, 2, 3, 4, like,
yeah,
several meanings. So it's, but it's still there. So you can actually find it. But yeah, so the word Turk became synonymous with all these, you know, traits, tyrannical, treats their wife badly, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So that in writings of the time, you find people using the term without having to explain it. And that's the understood meaning of it. You know, so if someone says, oh, you Turk, they're not necessarily saying you're from the Ottoman Empire. They're saying you're a tyrannical man. You see this in Jane Eyre. You see this, you know, in sort of a lot of the literature of the period.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, I did not know those kind of roots of Western Islamophobia is right there. And I think in that word. So that was really interesting. And this is also where, like, this period of time, again, was so fascinating and eye-opening to me, where these English people going to the East, I guess, and then congratulating themselves and like reminding women that they were much better men than those men in the East who had those harems, and which, again, you said they hadn't even seen. They were using their imaginations about what that even meant. So I wanted to ask you how Western women used the notion of the harem and the quote-unquote oppressed Muslim woman in their feminism. And you talked about Mary Astle, but then even Mary Wollstonecraft, too, employed the trope of the seraglio, right, or the harem to say, like, oh, look, we're so much better, right? Can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah. So I talked about a few steps, I guess. So the first is, as you said, the English men who go over there and then come back. You know, so one was William Bedulph, who goes to Aleppo, which is now in present-day Syria. He goes as a preacher, tradesman, you know, all those jobs are combined somehow. And he comes back, he writes a memoir of the trip, a travelogue, and he says, you know, English women have a great deal to learn from the women there who are so simple, who really, you know, like, what is it, they stand up when their husband comes into the room and they kiss their hand. And, you know, so I think his point was English women should learn from the women over there and how simple they are and how subservient they are to their husbands. And then from that, it followed that they should appreciate what they have because we could be like those men there. So William Bedulph, in his 1609 account as a preacher to the company of English merchants in Aleppo, you know, he expresses his hope that English women will read his book and realize how fortunate they are compared to women elsewhere. So the quote is, "Here in England, wives may learn to love their husbands when they shall read in what slavery women live in other countries, and in what awe and subjection to their husbands, and what liberty and freedom they themselves enjoy." So he called Islam a devilish religion, and, you know, and the men enjoy all these liberties and women don't. And so English women could learn a thing or two and appreciate what they have here. He talked about the Muslim woman having to rise to greet her husband when he returns from a trip, and she bows herself to her husband and kisses his hand, and then, having offered him her own seat, stands so long as he is in presence. Such deference, Bedulph believed, was worthy of emulation. He goes on to say, if the like order were in England, women would be much more faithful and dutiful to their husbands than many of them are. So this is one take on women of the East. The other one I had in mind is Thomas Rowe, who goes to the Mughal court as an ambassador of King James I of England. King James succeeds Queen Elizabeth as an emissary from King James and really of the East India Company, which has been described as the first multinational corporation of the world, or one of the first. So he goes there, and there he is trying to get those trading privileges I mentioned earlier from the Mughal Emperor Jahangir. But Jahangir is not, it turns out, the decision maker. It's his wife, Nur Jahan, who is behind, who doesn't interact with men she's not related to. So he knows that she is responsible for making the final decision to give him trading privileges or not. So he's upset because here's this woman who has the right to make this decision, and she's a Muslim woman, and this is not what I'd heard about Muslim women. They're not supposed to be these decision makers. And it's also weird because, you know, he grew up, he was born, and I think it was about 24 or 25 when Queen Elizabeth died. So he's familiar with the idea of a female monarch. And Queen Elizabeth was a, you know, formidable character. But then when he goes to India, he doesn't expect to find a powerful queen. So he's upset that she surprises him in her behavior. And she, you know, he's irritated that, you know, I thought I would come and get these privileges, and now all this lies in the hands of this woman who I can't even see. Right. So then these are two images. So this is how men were dealing with the idea of the Muslim woman. We've talked about the harem already. Women like Mary Astle and Wollstonecraft, but even in between, for them, they used the figure of the Muslim woman. And for me, this is an example of how Muslim women figure in the global politics of feminism. It's not that they were, as I said, you know, working together or anything like that, but the idea of the Muslim woman was pretty important to the idea of feminism, as was, of course, slavery and other issues like that. But you know, I only touch on that briefly. Others have written about that. So Estelle, you know, talks about ideas like Muslim women have no souls. This was very central to how Wollstonecraft, Estelle, and others thought about Muslim women, that they are all concubines, or even that whether they're a wife or a concubine, they have no rights. So there's one, Sarah Cowper, Lady Sarah Cowper, she, you know, left a 2,300-page journal about her married life to Sir William Cowper. And there's a passage where she complains when he treats her badly. I think he complains when about dinner or linens or something. And she says, he's treating me like an Eastern concubine, right? So that's an example. So it's, you know, it's the way the word Turk took on a certain meaning, the word concubine took on a certain meaning. And what's interesting is that you didn't need to explain it, right? If you say concubine, it's, oh yeah, yeah, those Muslim women who are all concubines and have no rights within their household. So Estelle has versions, you know, uses several terms like this. Cowper is another example. And then Wollstonecraft, who is called the foremother of Anglo-American feminism, she does it very clearly numerous times. And again, many scholars have written about this. For me, it was about how I could fit it into my longer genealogy. So the way she uses it is to demand rights for English women by saying, we English women are not like the women in the harem, in the seraglio. We have souls unlike them, et cetera, et cetera. So you can't treat us like them, right? So they became a foil against which English women were to be measured and compared. So don't treat us like them. Give us rights, because otherwise you're reducing us to being like those caged, uneducated, soulless women, and you're making yourselves, the men, like the tyrannical Turk. Mm-hmm. Right? So this language is, you know, throughout the Vindication of the Rights of Woman, which is her famous text from 1792.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so Muslim women feature in this bizarre way throughout this founding text.
And one of the really interesting and important things that you point out too are the ironies that existed, right? Because while these Western, or specifically British women, are saying these things, they themselves don't have certain rights that the women in Muslim countries already had. Can you talk about that? It's like a few of those ironies.
So again, you know, even in Muslim countries, they had these rights. In theory, they didn't always have them in paper. I mean, we know the gap between law and reality here today. But Islam in the 7th century gave women the right to contract, the right to own property, you know, all of these rights. Whereas in Europe at the same time, you could be an independently wealthy, unmarried woman. But as soon as you got married, you would be covered by the law of coverture, which meant that, you know, a man and woman, you get married and you become one, and the one is the man. You know, the man has full control over the woman's property. Whereas in Islam, a woman would retain control over her property. So they didn't know this, or chose not to know this. Mary Montagu, who was of noble background, but had no property of her own once she was married, she felt this in a very visceral way when she went to Constantinople in the mid-18th century, because she saw how independent the women, you know, she goes as the spouse of a diplomat, of an English aristocrat. So she's operating at a very elite level, right? She's going to elite homes. She's interacting with elite women. So we need to be mindful of which level, class level we're talking about. So she sees these independently wealthy women. And so she feels the pain in a visceral way that, you know, I don't have access to this kind of wealth, even though I'm supposedly an aristocratic woman, because the laws of my land don't allow me these freedoms. But again, you know, she wrote a lot of things that should have challenged the ideas about Muslims and Muslim men and women in her time. But she was up against a very powerful narrative about what Muslims were like. So, you know, it gets ignored. And there were others, like a playwright earlier, De La Riviere Manley, who wrote a play about polygamy. She had been cheated herself by being tricked into a bigamous marriage. And so her point, again, it wasn't to reform Muslim societies. It wasn't a savior mentality, but she was using these ideas about the Muslim world to criticize English society, saying, you know, we have such things happening here and we shouldn't have them happening here. But she also portrayed the Ottoman Emperor Suleiman's wife, Ruxolana, in a more positive way than others had. Because, you know, any smart woman would have been seen as a threat by a man from any place. So they depicted her as this, you know, cunning, scheming woman. And, you know, she depicted her in a more positive way. So there were these positive depictions of life and women and men and relationships in the Muslim world. But the bulk of the narrative was going in a different direction. So it was very hard to, you know, make a dent in that.
I think two other things that, to my understanding, are protected rights in the Quran are divorce, right? And then maybe not, I don't know exactly how it's written, but it seems like more of an integrated and normalized sexuality for women, at least more than Western women enjoyed at the time, right? So those seem to be really, really significant things that benefited Muslim women at the time, too, that these British women just didn't even know about, or like you said, chose not to know about, I guess. There was no way for them to have known about it, I guess.
I mean, you know, it's similar to now, right? I mean, there's a dominant discourse about what's happening around the world, right? Including in Palestine. And so anything that's contrary to that, it's very hard for people to say, wait, but everyone else is saying something else. So why should I believe, you know, the other narrative?
Right.
So similarly, then yes, marriage in Islam is a contract, not a sacrament. There's no such until we die.
Yeah, so that do its part.
Yeah, it's a contract. And in theory, both sides can write in whatever they want into that contract, including if you marry another woman, we're automatically divorced, right? So people, you know, women can do that. Again, in reality, not every, even Muslim women aren't always aware of this right. Muslim men may choose not to be aware that but you know, it's a contract. So in practice, all kinds of things go wrong. But in theory, it's a contract and you can write anything reasonable, obviously, into it, which has always meant that divorce is definitely far easier among Muslims than it is in Christianity. Even Catholicism, of course, is more complicated, but even easier than among Protestants, because it wasn't seen as this lifelong commitment, but in so I mean, there are stipulations and things that have to be met very often, so it's not super easy. And the Quran does say it's not something one should undertake lightly, right? So it's not, I think it's described as abominable even, but it's there as needed, right? Because sometimes you just need to end a relationship, so that provision is there. I'm sorry, what was the other thing?
Well, just a more normalized sexuality for women.
Yeah.
Like enjoyment of it.
Yeah. There is no idea of nuns and monks and monasteries. You do not show your devotion to God by being celibate, by renouncing sexuality. So I don't know that I spend too much time in the book on this, but, you know, there are hadith sayings of the Prophet where there's one famous one that's often cited, where someone asks about coitus interruptus, and the Prophet says, well, make sure, you know, you're mindful of your female partner when you do this, because, you know, it can be very abrupt. So, you know, shower her with kisses, etc. Like, there's all this discussion. But the main point is that Islam talks a great deal about the significance of family and healthy sexual relations, all that stuff. So celibacy, chastity, all these things are not how you show devotion to God. But on the other hand, sexuality, it's very clear, has to be, should be within marriage. Sexuality is healthy, but it doesn't mean you can go have sex with anyone anytime, anyhow. Right? So marriage is really important in Islam because it's a way to regulate, like to provide a legal place for sexuality.
That makes sense. Okay, I wanted to see if you could talk about a few other customs that Europeans judged very harshly when they came to the subcontinent and then used these practices as an excuse for colonization, which you mentioned before happened all the way until the recent past with Laura Bush and our invasion of Afghanistan. But in the context that you were talking about, could we talk quickly about sati, about polygamy, and about purda?
Okay. So sati is a practice of widow immolation, and it was practiced by a fraction of upper caste Hindus. So it's not a Muslim thing. But because it was so sensational to British eyes, they made it one of their big reasons for intervention, you know, similar to the blue burqas that they saw in Afghanistan. Again, they were there for the riches of South Asia, but sati was something that they, you know, honed in on, zeroed in on as something, you know, we need to put a stop to. So it just became a big issue. But there were also local reformers who were very interested in putting an end to it because it made them look more modern. So scholars have written about how this was played out on the bodies of Indian women, again, Hindu women. So it was not a widespread practice, but in size, and because it's such a dramatic thing, you know, it figures in Around the World in 80 Days by Jules Verne, the French writer. It was something like the harem. It became this obsession when talking about the women of India. Mm-hmm. So sati, and then polygamy is, I don't think I detail this in the book. It doesn't come up in quite the same way, but polygamy was also fascinating, right? It's so different from what's happening here. And I just told you about De La Rivière Manley writing in the 17th century, an English playwright who said, yeah, but you know, it happens here too. I've been tricked into polygamy. So in Islam, the Quran is very clear. You may take up to 4 wives, but you have to treat them all equally. And then it says, but because it's impossible to treat 4 wives equally, we suggest you take just one. So since most interpretations of the Quran have been done by men historically, they chose to read it in a way that sort of ignores the last part, or they claim that they can treat women equally. So the reason many Muslim scholars, feminist scholars, and even modernist male scholars of the Quran, how they made sense of this is, one, before Islam, men in Arabia could actually inherit the women of their father's household as chattel, basically. Like, you inherit possessions and you inherit the women. So you could have hundreds of women, you know, depending on the wealth of the household. And the wives, I think maybe even the officially married wives. So to say 4 was actually to limit that previous practice. Other thing happening in this time is that many men were dying in a war, right? So there's an imbalance in the numbers of men and women. And women then were, many women were economically dependent on men. So one reason for this provision, scholars have argued, is that it allows women who are left without a provider to be brought into a household in a legal way. So what you're doing is taking someone in so that you can provide for them economically. Today, many feminist scholars are arguing, Muslim feminist scholars, you don't need that. If you can ensure that women are not financially dependent on men, you don't need this provision, right? So that's the need. So that's the justification of these reform movements to very severely limit polygamy or to even ban it altogether. So I think Tunisia, for example, has banned polygamy, even though a Muslim majority country. So that's where polygamy is now. I'm sorry, what was your third? Oh, purda.
Purda.
So purda comes from the Persian word parda, and it's used in South Asia because Persian was the main language of the imperial court and the legal courtrooms until the 19th century. So it was the language of the elite in that sense. Purda just means curtain. So it's tied to the idea of the harem and seclusion. The idea that, you know, men and women have separate quarters in the homes that can afford it, or the burqa has been described as a form of portable seclusion. So if women stay within the home, then they just operate in different parts of the house from men who are not part of the family. Men come in from outside. But if you leave the house, then you take your seclusion with you. So that's when you cover up and act modest, I mean, when you go outside, and you know, there's a great deal of discussion about what exactly is prescribed in the Quran. Some people say it's, you know, fully covered face and everything. Others say that's not it. Yet others will say the Quranic verses about modesty of a particular kind were directed to the wives of the Prophet only because they were recognizable, obviously, as prominent figures in the community. It doesn't mean that everyone has to, that all women have to veil to this day. So there's a great deal of discussion, which is as it should be. Like, you know, there's no set answer on this.
Yeah, and a great deal of variety, even in the Muslim women that I know. Like, just like every religion, right? And like every group of people, you're going to see lots of different interpretations and personalities. And
absolutely.
Yeah, those were all really interesting issues. And to hear you talk about them again, to talk about sati, and thank you for emphasizing again that that was a Hindu practice, not a Muslim practice. But it just strikes me in all of these examples that no one's defending that and saying that that was a great practice. But the point that I took away in the book and that I'm taking away now, again, is it's just not the business. It's not the responsibility. And it's not appropriate for an outside person to come in. And it's not necessary. It's just so patronizing to come in and say, well, we know better and we're going to tell you what is and isn't okay with all of these issues that you're bringing up. Because you're even describing now kind of indigenous and native movements to decide what they want to do, what feels appropriate to them. And just it's just the patronizing outsiders coming in and saying, this is bad. We're going to tell you how to do it.
Yeah. So what's interesting is that when they come in and say something is bad, people who might have been critical of it before go on the defensive, right? So it actually makes it much harder for local reformers because then they'll say, oh, you're telling us it's bad? No, we're going to sort of double down and say that this is part of our culture. So that's happened time and again in Muslim countries and in other, you know, so even with sati, there have been Hindu leaders who said, this is our custom, it's our culture, don't intervene. And so they end up defending it in a way that they might not have if outsiders hadn't come in and made an issue of it. People have made the similar argument about the veil, like the veil, you know, whatever that means. Like, as you say, there's so many different ways of, you know, covering your hair, of being modest, etc. But it didn't become it was just the way people dressed, you know, in that part of the world. You protect yourself from the sun or you come. And non-Muslim women also covered their hair, like Catholic women going to mass in the Mediterranean. And Leila Ahmed, a scholar of Islam, has argued that it was very commonplace in pre-Islamic Arabias, and it was adopted by Muslims because it was already out there being practiced by elite women of other communities. So the veil, too, in the 19th century, you know, the British come to India, to Egypt, all these places, and they say, oh, what is this weird thing? And that's when the veil becomes a symbol to rally sort of Muslims around. And so it's the one that has to be defended against all onslaught, etc. Whereas before, it was just what people wore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again,
eventually, that's that effect on this.
Yeah, for sure. And just the arbitrariness, too, of people's different dress standards just strikes me, too, because for Victorian women to make a criticism about covering your body when you couldn't show your wrist or your ankles in England is just so silly. Anyway, okay.
No, oh, sorry. Like all these men went out to save women of the other parts of the world, you know, from... So Leila Ahmed also has written about Lord Cromer, who goes to Egypt and, you know, he shuts down medical school for women because he thinks women have no business being doctors, but then talks about the veil. And back home, he's the head of the Men's League opposed to female suffrage, right? So there are all these inconsistencies down to George Bush, but also more recent people who are talking about women in other parts of the world as being oppressed, while they're cutting back on reproductive rights here, you know, like men who would not be considered feminists here.
Right.
And they're the ones going overseas and being feminists overseas, possibly.
Yes. And like you talked about, too, in some of these situations, their aim in being there in the first place is for wealth, it's for control and power, and then they use it as an excuse.
Yeah.
They use saving people as an excuse.
Yeah.
And it just seems like that's happened over and over.
Yeah.
Well, maybe if we have time for a couple more things, Elora, I want to kind of move forward on the timeline, and you recount really kind of the white supremacy in American feminists, the white feminism that has kind of plagued us for generations. And you write about specifically Germaine Greer, who, if listeners don't know, was a very prominent feminist in the 70s. And she had gone to India, as I think was fashionable in the 60s and 70s. And she had spent a few months in India. And then she spoke at a conference about the Indian problems while Indian women themselves sat there listening to her. So she kind of supposed herself then an authority. And I wonder if we could use that anecdote as a springboard to just talk about this issue in general.
Yeah, that's a good one. So I think she was born in Australia, but she's representative of feminism. So the 1960s and 70s, what has been called second wave feminism, but has also been criticized because there are many problems with the idea of the waves. It takes off. And at some point, there's this new arrogance, like the arrogance of the 19th century feminists I mentioned, that, you know, we have arrived, and yet look at the women over there, right? Mm-hmm. So it gives us a sense of superiority to feminists here. What we think of the Gloria Steinems and Betty Friedans and Germaine Greers is, of course, elite white feminism. So they were heavily criticized by women of color, even within this country, for only talking about their issues. So the best way to think about the relationships between these different movements, sort of last quarter of the 20th century coming into the 21st, is that when these famous people, the classic names of second wave feminism, were talking, they were focused on issues that they considered to be women's issues, very narrowly defined, because as white women, they were seen as unraced, right? They don't have a race, and so they can just focus on what they see as women's issues, whereas women of color in this country and Muslim women and, women all over the world, whatever their background, had to combine their fight for women's rights with, as I said before, the fight against colonialism, the fight against occupation, the fight against racism in this country. So they couldn't, for them, there was no such thing as a women's issue that was divorced from everything else. So the Germaine Greer example I give, she shows up a few times in different events in the book, is that, she'd been to India, she'd come back so she could speak about it. So for me, it's a great example of, this discussion of the relationship between knowledge and power, mm-hmm. right? So much of the writing in feminism, initially, much of the writing about other parts of the world, what we get from Edward Said's Orientalism, for example, is that people in the West are able to travel to other parts of the world much more easily. And then they come back and they write, they get published, they get circulated, and so they get heard. So Germaine Greer can go to India for a few weeks or months, I forget, come back and then be invited by whoever organized the conference. Why don't you tell us about Indian women,
yeah.
right? When there are actual Indian women, and it's not that Indian women, I think there are actual Indian scholars in the audience, right? Not just, it's not about identity, but about people who have experience and expertise about these other parts of the world. They're not taken as seriously, or even worse, they are taken as biased about, mm-hmm. right? The worry is that they wouldn't be able to be objective about India or Islam or Muslims, whereas someone who is white is automatically assumed to be scientific and objective. So I think that's a lot of what's going on. So a lot of the writings about, published here about Muslims or about any other part of the world has been done originally by white men and then increasingly white women, but they didn't recognize the privileges they enjoy. The fact that they can afford to go to other parts of the world, they have funding to go there, they have the passport that allows them to visit other parts of the world in a way that people from other parts of the world can't come here as easily and and do the same thing. And when they do, they don't get the same kind of circulation. Oh, what university do you teach in? Or you know, where are you from? Like, it's hard to break into the publishing world to get your words out. So I think I talk about Nawal al-Sadawi, who was this very famous Egyptian feminist, like going to conference after conference where these white women were talking about parts of the world that they had very flimsy and superficial knowledge of, when there are real experts that were could have been brought in, or were actually sitting in the audience having to listen to, you know, Germaine Greer's knowledge of India based on a Craig visit.
Yeah. So that leads us to kind of the last question that I wanted to ask you, and that is, what are some takeaways for listeners who want to be better allies to their Muslim sisters, and specifically listeners who aren't Muslim? How can we be better allies?
So one of the things I try to do throughout the book, I think there's been, as I said, lots of studies on, you know, anti-Muslim racism or Islamophobic practices, or, you know, the old, you know, going back to the Middle Ages and early modern era, anti-Islam hostility. I didn't want to focus just on those. I mean, those things are there, so they come up. I was much more interested, or as interested, in bringing out people who were willing to challenge the dominant narrative, right? So De La Rivière Manley, Mary Montague, right, fighting against what Mary Estelle and Wollstonecraft and these others were saying at the same time. So throughout and all the way down to the present, there are people, non-Muslim travelers from Europe and North America, who go and really try to understand and go beyond the narratives that they had been immersed in before. So I think even to this day, it's the same idea. Like, we know that there's a dominant narrative out there. In fact, I was thinking, when you're talking about the Turk, it's the same now, right? Mm-hmm. Palestinian equals terrorist, right? There are these associations that are out there. So to go beyond these dominant narratives, so part of it is education. Part of it, there are materials, you know, you'll probably get a better sense of the different narratives in social media now, which is scary, than in the mainstream media, because the mainstream media is fairly homogeneous. But of course, there are a lot of books and articles and material. You don't have to be an academic person or a scholar to read some of this material. There are, you know, I have colleagues and friends who write for the popular press. I mean, it's easy to find those to educate yourself, because it's very easy just to let the mainstream ideas just come in and say, oh, well, that's what I'm hearing everywhere I'm immersed, and that's what, that must be true. No, just question those narratives and dig beyond to find alternative ideas, and then make up your own mind, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not, I'm not saying believe this and don't believe that. It's like, look at the different stories and see which one really makes most sense. And then meet people who are not like yourself, right? But meet people who are, you know, Muslim or indigenous, like on any issue, like talk to the people from those communities and talk to more than one person so that you can see the differences among them, because, you know, there's variety within these communities, right? Not all Black people, not all Indigenous people, not all Muslim are the same. So I think it's, you know, going beyond your comfort zone. And, you know, and I talk to students here at Berkeley, like many of them have come from small towns where they didn't know people who were different from themselves. And then coming here, meeting other students who are different. I mean, even here, they could stay in their bubble, and many of them do. They stay in their familiar bubbles, but many sort of, you know, reach out beyond that, and they talk about how eye-opening that's been. So I think, like, it takes effort. So fun. And then once you meet these people, like, what do they say, you know, about a particular issue, whether it's the veil or Palestine or, you know, in the environment, right? Like, how do they see it? What are their thoughts on it? I think it just takes effort, and some effort is easier than others, but I think that's where it has to happen. Like, how do they understand feminism?
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. And I will say again to listeners, your very first step should be to buy this book. Again, it's called, I'm serious, it was just so wonderful. It's called Sisters in the Mirror, A History of Muslim Women and the Global Politics of Feminism. And again, Dr. Elora Shehabuddin, thank you so much for being here. I learned so much from you and I'm really grateful for your time. Thank you.
Amy, thank you. I really enjoyed our conversation and thank you for your kind words about the book.
And that wraps up today's episode. Before I go, I want to thank Sam Rose Preminger for our editing and production and Aubrey Iyer for our social media. And as always, I want to thank you listeners for being here. Make sure to check out our YouTube channel, Breaking Down Patriarchy, which features short, super entertaining videos that were created specifically to be able to share with friends and family members. Huge thanks to Ralph Blair and Aubrey Iyer for their genius work on that series. And if you want to show your appreciation for this excellent ad-free content, the most helpful thing you can do is to forward this episode to your friends and family and leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. These reviews really do help people find the podcast, and the more people listen, the greater the impact of this grassroots movement to break down the patriarchal structures in our institutions and our relationships and build egalitarian structures in their place. Thanks again for joining me, and make sure to tune in next time for another fascinating episode on Breaking Down Patriarchy.